Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes, copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author had a chipmunk, whom she had named Cheeky, eating out of her hand and coming into her house. We resume with Suburban Safari number 6 on page 54. Cheeky grows bolder. If no seeds wait on his stool in the morning, he goes into search mode. If I'm on the couch in the living room, he'll pitta-pitta-pitta into find me, then pop up onto my knee. If my sweatshirt pocket holds seeds, he smells them and wriggles in. Like my crows, Cheeky becomes a friend. When I hear his feet pitta-ing through the house in the morning, I can call Cheeky Cheeks, and he'll track me down. I can pat my thigh, and he'll scramble up my leg and perch in my hand. Generally, he works for a couple of hours in the morning, then retires. If I let him, he can spirit away 2 cups of seeds. He drinks only rarely, and only about once a week do I notice a dime-sized puddle on the floor. His water-saving poops are another matter. He's free and easy with those, especially when startled by a sudden noise. But they're dry and easy to manage, and I wouldn't care if they weren't. I love this chipmunk. There's something breathtaking about the trust of a wild animal. I'm flattered that this small creature can overlook the strangeness of my species and hang out with me. The only hitch in our relationship is that seeds must be present. If Cheeky climbs my leg and finds no reward, he hurls himself to the floor with a disgusted splat, and he never makes eye contact. When he does look at me, it's to see if I'm wearing climbable clothing, or to measure his leap from my leg to my shoulder. Sometimes I wonder if, in his view, I'm just a strange kind of tree. But I don't care. Cheeky's my pal, and as the summer parches, I'm glad I can lend him a paw. Even a dry spell here isn't rainless, and when the rain does fall, the whole yard seems to sigh in relief. Cardinals and crows shake their plumage in the sprinkles, catching a bath. The oak leaves shed a layer of dust that has settled on them. Down in the soil, I imagine the springtails and earthworms are squirming happily in the moisture. The only malcontent is Cheeky. He won't work in the rain. He stays home. And even when the weather clears, some parts of his tunnel complex must remain muddy. The first time he pitters into the kitchen with red earth caked on his face, I laugh aloud and scare him under the stove. When he comes out and settles into his seed cup, I assess the damage. One ear is pasted tight against his head and filled with mud. Streaks of red mute his stripes. Gritty glue has hardened his cream-colored eyebrows into spikes. He looks like evil Cheeky. He couldn't possibly care less. But I like my Chippy soft and kissable. When he goes out to unload, I moisten a kitchen sponge and wait by the seeds. Squirr! Cheeky protests as I dab his ear. But he doesn't lift his head from the cup. I push harder, trying not to mash his face into the seeds. Squirr! The mud has set like cement. The sponge clogs. His ear is half done when he packs in the final seed and sprints out the door. I rinse the sponge and resume on his next visit. It takes a good half hour and a great deal of complaining to clean him up. I can't get all the mud off his eyebrows, so he wears an enraged expression for the rest of the morning. The next day, he's silky again. I expect the mud grooms off easily when it's dry. Animals who live in the elements must have evolved ways to deal with excess water, just as they have ways of dealing with shortage. To combat scarcity, birds keep an eye peeled for the glint of water whenever they're cruising over the planet's surface. If they don't win a nesting territory that incorporates water, they have to commute to it. In my neighborhood, they needn't commute far to find surface water. One spring day my ramblings lead me southwest, a few blocks to a patch of woods. Surrounded by suburban homes, it's 20 acres of bedrock ridges and trees. Caught in the rocky troughs, I find a series of shallow ponds, and flitting around the ponds are a series of warblers. These aren't residents, but migrants who have broken their journey to drink at these teacups. Still, a commute of just a few blocks is risky for a little bird like a goldfinch or a chickadee. It exposes him to sharp-shinned hawks. In mating season, it leaves his wife unchaperoned, and later it cuts into the time he could spend feeding his children. When I bought my bird bath, it became clear that water is a valuable commodity in the neighborhood. My little oasis was mobbed. Goldfinches, housefinches, and cardinals gathered in the lilacs and the chokecherry tree, waiting a turn to drink. The catbirds bathed daily, flapping half the water out of the basin. And someone used the bath to soak their French fries. I had my suspicions, but I checked the website of crow scholar Kevin McGowan to confirm. Sure enough, the crows are using the public fountain as their crock pot. From what I read, my crows are being fairly polite. Someone else wrote to McGowan's site about a backyard bird bath that's all astew with dead snakes and rodents. The crow man offers two possible explanations. One, when crows are feeding a nesting mom, they bring her water by soaking her victuals. Two, McGowan speculates, crows may just like their food a bit on the putrid side. Between the splashy catbirds and the crows' bloated snacks, the bird bath wants freshening every day. The patrons of the broiler pan are more mannerly. Squirrels drink daintily from the edge. Blue jays bathe there, but less boisterously than catbirds. I dump the pan every few days in case nobody's eating the mosquito eggs that are deposited there at night. As for my plant citizens, I give them not a drop of water. The oak tree, the black raspberries, and the native asters are surely adapted to waiting out a dry year. Everyone else can sink or swim. I'm not going to siphon water out of Sebago Lake to coddle English grass and clover. Of the three waters flowing through my yard, surface water feels the drought quickest. The skin of the earth is drying. Less water is migrating through the soil. Streams, which gather half their volume from the ground around them, are shrinking. They're slow to refill the lakes. In suburbs and cities, the surface water is especially hard hit. Even in a wet year, the profusion of pavement sluices rainwater away from the soil. Rain that falls onto cement or asphalt usually flows into a gutter, then down a drain, and is piped away to the sewage treatment plant. The soil is cheated of this moisture, and the loss is colossal. Scientists have calculated that pavement is costing the city of Dallas between 6 and 14 billion gallons of water a year, and Atlanta as much as 133 billion gallons. Underneath the asphalt umbrellas is parched soil and a dwindling supply of groundwater. Here in my gasping yard, dust and dirt are building up on both the paved driveway and the lawn. When rain does occasionally fall, perhaps 70% of it sinks into the sandy soil. If the day is hot, a fair amount evaporates. The remainder rolls downhill, especially if it lands on slanted ground. The runoff washes squirrel dung and lawnmower oil off my lawn, dust off the roof of my house, engine oil off my driveway, dog manure off the sidewalk, grass fertilizer off one neighbor's yard, and dandelion killer off another's. The runoff also gathers heat from the roof, the tar, and the ground. Hot and dirty water slips towards the ocean, following a fold in the landscape. When my runoff trickles into the beach sand and mingles with salt water, it bestows all its heat and grime upon the Atlantic. This is how E. coli bacteria, pesticides, fertilizers, and an Exxon Valdez's worth of oil runs, spot by spot, quart by quart, into the water bodies of the United States each year. As grubby as my yard sounds, I'm surprised to learn that farmland can also be a toxic tea bag. Lawn owners and farmers alike are prone to overdosing their crops with pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers. If they scatter the chemicals before a rain, that much more will depart with the rolling water. Right now, the scariest ingredient in the tea bag is atrazine, a popular weed killer. Corn and sorghum farmers spray it in the spring, and rain carries it into the water soon thereafter. People drink it. Frogs grow up in it, and one scientist has shown that it can make them hermaphrodites. That's just one chemical. Nitrogen, in the forms of dung and fertilizer, also lies on the surface of farmland, waiting to be washed off. When too much nitrogen flows into a pond or a slow-moving stream, it overfeeds the resident algae, whose subsequent decomposition sucks oxygen from the water, suffocating fish and other creatures. So, while hot and overpaved towns like mine foul rainwater with heat, manure, and chemicals, they are not the only offender. One solution to the gunk that washes off my yard is to capture the water and give it time to sink into the soil. The longer it spends in the company of soil microbes, the cleaner it will be. At the same time, it will rehydrate my soil, nourish my plants, dampen my insects, and keep my food chain chewing. I wade through a pile of research to see what the ideal driveway pavement might be, but conclude that almost anything that slows flowing water will work. I could dig a holding ditch on either side of my driveway. I could channel all the runoff into one swale. I could replace the asphalt with special pavers that let water sink in between them. But I suppose the simplest plan might be the one I've already begun. I'm letting weeds colonize and destroy the existing pavement. As for the roof runoff, I suppose I ought to dig big holes under my downspouts and fill them with rocks and sand. Better yet, I'd channel the gutters into a cistern and use it to water the organic corn I'd grow where the lilacs are. Maybe next year. In my yard, this water that falls from the sky is only one branch of a three-pronged river. It's the most visible third, and the third that most quickly reflects the character of my neighborhood. It's the third that keeps the top inches of the soil moist and fills low spots with water for squirrels, skunks, and birds to drink. It's the third that gathers the jetsam of town life and delivers it into the neighboring streams, lakes, and ocean. But it's only a third. If I, like Cheeky and the Crows, used water only for hydrating my food and flesh, I could probably get by on what falls from the sky. But I need more than the 2 quarts I drink each day. To shower, wash clothing, and flush the toilet, I use another 50 or 60 gallons a day. While this is half the amount used by the average American, it's still more than my yard can supply. To slake our cultural thirst, we human beings build our own metal-clad or masonry watersheds, which we direct into our towns. An artificial river now flows right through my house. This cast-iron river starts 15 miles northwest of my house at Sebago Lake. It splits into thousands of branches, one of which flows under my street and into my basement. It breaks into daylight from a number of faucets, then carries my skin flakes and deodorant, my excreted caffeine and solid waste. The cast-iron river plunges back down into the sewer. At the treatment plant downtown, some of my contributions are removed. Then we've got no further use for this river, so we release it into Casco Bay. Because I don't water my lawn, the cast-iron river is almost completely separate from my natural watershed. I do transfer a few gallons a day from the cast iron to nature when I refill the bird baths and Cheeky's dish. And I'm ambivalent about it. Rainwater isn't clean by any stretch. It rinses buckets of pollutants down from the atmosphere. But tap water is even more intensely flavored. Traditionally, water agencies use chlorine to kill the bacteria that beavers, birds, and bathers deposit in surface water. Chlorine works brilliantly against germs, but it also reacts with the corpses of leaves and other organic dross in the water, forming a group of chemicals called trihalomethanes, or THM. THM concentrations vary from one water system to the next, depending on the local supply of organic junk, the water temperature, and technology. Scientists are still investigating how much THM is safe to drink for a young woman who hopes to give birth to healthy kids. I wonder, though, how THM might affect Cheeky, the squirrels, and the birds. Their bodies are so different from mine. Cheeky, for all I know, is a girl monk who'll have monklets next spring, so I'm relieved when I read that the Portland Water District has switched from chlorine to ozone for disinfection. The THM level in my tap water has zeroed out. That doesn't mean the cast iron is composed of H2O alone. In addition to the minerals dissolved off the landscape by flowing rain and snow, this piped river contains chemicals that engineers pour into it on purpose. They add sodium hydroxide to lower the acidity. They toss in zinc orthophosphate, which coats old lead pipes in people's houses and thereby preserves IQ points. And they run a stream of fluoride into the river to preserve the teeth of children. And chipmunks? Presumably. The fluoride is the only additive that raises serious concerns in humans. Questions about it eroding our bones and discoloring our teeth won't go away. But as for Cheeky, he's going to confront hazards far more fatal than blotchy teeth. More alarming than the chemicals that engineers add to the cast iron are the chemicals IP into the river. Recently, a series of tests have found that treated wastewater, which pours into streams, lakes, and oceans, holds enough drugs to dose a whale. Antibiotics, painkillers, epilepsy meds, spermicides, deodorants, acne cures, antidepressants, and lots of caffeine are among the products we spill into the false rivers that pass through our homes. How our doped pee impacts wildlife and plant life is just now being studied. Spermicides and antibiotics seem to devastate algae. Prozac apparently slows the development of fish and tadpoles. To take an optimistic view, maybe the algae-killing antibiotics counteract the algae-feeding nitrogen that washes in from farms. And perhaps Prozac helps the frogs take a positive approach to the news that atrazine is turning them into hermaphrodites. The third branch of my water system is invisible. It's the water that falls elsewhere, then migrates for decades or even millennia through fractured bedrock and gravel. Deep beneath my yard is a water world that flows on a time scale that makes a mockery of my kitchen clock. Dwelling in it are citizens who never see the sun. This is the world of groundwater, and the only way I can investigate it is to call a dowser, a water witch. Suppressing an eye roll, I dial the number. I've already tried the rational approach to envisioning groundwater. I've connected the high points on a topographical map of the neighborhood and thus outlined my little watershed. My yard sits in the middle of a shell-shaped dent in the land. When rain falls uphill from me, some of it trickles down through the soil, then down deeper into rock. Presumably, gravity keeps pulling it downhill toward the ocean. But what path does this groundwater take under my yard? Does it follow the cobbled course of a buried riverbed? Does it zigzag through fractures in bedrock? Is there a roaring river under my lawn? Or an Everglades-like sheet of dark water? Or just a hard desert of watertight stone? I've read about groundwater, trying to learn its habits, but I was quickly distracted by the animals who live in it. I found an entire book dedicated to them, with a title so fun to say that it's permanently etched in my brain, Stygofauna Mundi. That's Latin for groundwater animals of the world. Stygofauna Mundi. Stygofauna Mundi. Oodles of groundwater animals live under my lawn. There are nematodes, little wormy things, and copepods, shrimpy things, and mollusks, ribbon worms, ostracods, isopods, even beetles. These folks live on organic crud that rain carries down through the soil, gravel, and rock, or they eat each other. The whole idea makes me itch with curiosity. I'd love to dig down to my groundwater level, look at these creatures, and size up their subterranean swamp. But I can't, so I await Roland Moore. Roland is slight and 85 years old. White hair peeks from under his tractor cap, and suspenders support his blue dickies. He leans a bit to one side. This, along with his glasses, gives the impression that he's trying to sidestep attention. At his truck, he hands me a bundle of miniature flagpoles, which he collects while maintaining his neighborhood cemetery. He retrieves slim brass L-rods from under the seat. The short end of each L disappears into a knot of red and blue knobs that make up Roland's hands. He's ready. He takes a position near Cheeky's primary hole. I struggle not to steer him away. I'm a bit embarrassed to report that Cheeky has become the sun around which my world revolves. A few weeks after he scampered into my life, I was working in my upstairs office when I sensed I was not alone. Looking around, I caught the familiar blur of his fur. He had conquered the stairs. Within a few minutes, he had popped from my footrest to my knee, launched from there to the keyboard tray, where he typed an apostrophe, then summited the desk. After that, I kept a seed cup on my desk. Any morning I spent there, I spent in the company of Cheeky. I'd hear his pitta-pitta-pitta on the stairs, and a few seconds later, I'd feel his claws on my leg. He'd dive into his work, then speed down the stairs. Through the window, I'd see him bounce off the deck and into the shrubbery where he hides one of his tunnel entrances. On the days that I woke early, opened the door, and returned to bed, Cheeky would pitta around until he found me. He'd make an exploration of my head until I got up to fill his cup. But, as thoroughly as Cheeky knew my home, all I knew of his burrow was what I'd read. It should be many yards long, with multiple doors and storerooms, and a bedroom. It was only by accident that I discovered one of his entrances. I happened to be looking one day when his head popped out of an old post hole. This 3-inch hole, lined with rocks, came with the house and had never before shown signs of life. Now that I know where to watch, I often see Cheeky emerge from it, and I avoid the area. I can only imagine what it sounds like to Cheeky when a massive primate thuds across his ceiling. But I don't tell Roland, and I don't take his elbow and lead him away. I don't want him to think I'm a nutball. Roland's rods sweep back and forth. This area, he says, is an area where we don't have any primary water. That was quick. But he's not done. Primary water is just the big stuff. My yard may have veins of water that flow off an underground spring or dome of water, he says. Roland shifts gears somehow and starts to walk toward the back of the yard. His stride is a shuffle, his black brogans scudding across the lawn. Just a few feet past Cheeky's hole, his fists tilt and the rods swing toward each other. Clink! He turns and follows the vein toward my right fence, pointing the rods at the ground when he nears the apple tree. He directs me to poke a mini flagpole into the ground. He follows the vein to the left fence, and I stick in another flagpole. He resumes his shuffle toward the back of the yard. He doesn't get far. We mark off 3 parallel veins that fall about 10 feet apart. Then he traces 3 more, that angle a bit. When Roland finds himself confronting the black raspberry canes, he announces, "That's about it." But that doesn't mean he's done. He swings around. Now Roland is going to tell me how deep each vein is. He goes to the last one we marked and stands on it. Holding the rods out, he mumbles to himself. "What are you saying?" I ask. He mumbles louder. "From the bottom of my foot to the top of this water vein is over 90 feet? Clink. "Over 100? The rods dip in denial. "From the bottom of my foot to the tip of this water is 99, 98, 97, 96. Clink. There you have it. 96 feet under my feet runs a vein of water. The other 7 veins inhabit the same depth, give or take a foot. Back by Cheeky's hole, Roland aims the rods at my north neighbor's yard. He's not sure, but he thinks the source of the water beneath my yard is a dome of water lying deep beneath the neighbor's apple tree. Right. We sit down on the deck to clarify a few things. When Roland sits, his fingers explore his knees and his feet rock and slide as though they're feeling for something. I ask why he uses L-rods instead of a forked stick. L-rods are best for tracing veins, he says. A Y-rod is harder, but you can use anything, he says. Whenever I'm driving over this way, I program my fingers. Then I ask if the drawbridge is open. I say, "Show me yes," and my finger might bend like this. I say, "Show me no," and it'll bend like that. Then I ask, "Is the bridge open?" Oh, dear. My skepticism was suspended by a thread while we did the water dousing. Now the thread breaks, and Roland isn't done yet. Probably more than finding water now, I clear houses of negative energy, he asserts. I get 3 or 4 calls a week for that. My face muscles fight amongst themselves. At a loss for what to say, I indulge morbid curiosity. His card, printed on glimmering red plastic, says he does biolocation on-site and remote. I ask what remote means. Roland replies that he doesn't have to leave home to douse. He can sit at his desk, draw a picture of the property in question, and program a handheld pendulum to give him answers. If he needs to divert a vein of water into a dry well or something, he might stab a little bar into the paper, then tap it one way or the other. Ah, this is going from bad to worse. I thank him, pay him extra for his time, and bid him adieu. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.